Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything we think we know about food. I'm Anthony Zara, and this episode was recorded live at the Food Matters Live event held in Manchester in November 2024. Now, the whole of the food industry is affected by science-based targets on sustainability. But whose targets are they? Are we aiming to satisfy consumer demand, the wants and needs of investors, or is the industry simply following what regulators say needs to be done? Our panel is made up of Gina Camfield, Head of ESG at Aramac UK and Global Offshore, Paul Irwin Rhodes, Head of Sustainability at Greggs, and Chris Shearlock, Sustainability Director for Europe at Thai Union.
I guess I'll start with an open question. Most times when people talk about science-based targets, they're talking about, say, what the consumers want or, say, what the industry is asking for. Some even talk about financiers and investors. But it almost seems like these guys are kind of waiting on what the regulation will say. For example, the insurance companies are thinking, God, the regulations will change very soon. And if I'm not insuring someone who has the wrong targets, I might run into trouble. So I guess my question is, when you set these targets, whose targets are they? Are they for the consumer? Do you pick and choose the targets based on what you anticipate the industry would want in the future? Or is it purely based on emission reduction as it entails? Any one of you can.
Who wants to go first?
Thai Union, if you don't know us, we're a massive seafood company. We're the world's biggest tuna processor in the UK. We own the John West brand, as an example. We do branded or private label canned fish for retailers all around Europe. So it could be Tesco in the UK, Lidl in Germany, Carrefour in France, etc. And more of them are demanding that you have science-based targets as a condition of doing business with them. So that's the fundamental driver. In some cases, they're setting cutoffs of if you're not there by 2026, etc., we're not going to work with you. So it's a very, very simple one. It's in response to customer demand. There will, of course, be investors. I don't tend to work with them as much, but there will be investors that are looking at this sort of thing, but it's customer demand.
For us at Aramark, it was business-led. We made the decision before we started seeing this sort of come into the tender processes. We were ahead of it. We knew that we needed to align our targets with our business targets. But I would say it's certainly helping us now when it comes to the clients. It is featuring in our tenders as well that you must have science-based targets to work with some of our clients. So it sort of put us in the forefront, which was nice.
And as I said, ours was really, it was business-led. Now, there are some influencers in there, so we were conscious that investors were asking about this, but it wasn't front and centre of the mind when we started on that journey. There's a couple of reasons for the business-led piece, which, I laboured on before. One was about that ambition bit and just making sure we were playing our part in line with our purpose and ambition, but there is the risk management piece of knowing if we've got a target and we maintain against it, when those changes happen from a policy point of view in the future, we're in a good place to mitigate against them. It's going to cost, when there's a carbon tax as a result of SBTs, it's going to cost me a lot less than it costs somebody who hasn't set such clear ambition.
So what would you say has been the biggest challenge? Everyone, there's tons of challenges, of course. What would be the biggest one that you imagine, especially not just for setting the targets, but, you know, as a going concern, because it's something you have to maintain over the long term. So based on what you've experienced so far, what do you think is the biggest challenge?
It's a point Gina made, actually, which is about data integrity. So from a scope 3 point of view, because we're all about food in this room, so from a scope 3 point of view, it's going to be the greater majority of your footprint. It's way out of your direct control. There's a million and one different models in terms of how you what comes back to you, whether it's LCA or whether it's just based on emissions factors or whatever. Managing that is a daily challenge for us. And making sure that our decision makers understand that that data changes and will mature and will get better and better and better is a is a is a constant sort of drumbeat. But I think the data piece is there is the most difficult one because it's very ethereal. It's not quite there yet. That's our biggest issue.
Yeah, I'd have to agree on that one, as we alluded to in our presentations. And I'd say the next challenge that we face is how are we going to get there, and holding ourselves, and not just ourselves in silo in our areas of our business, but actually holding the business accountable for those goals as well. Because whilst there might not be financial penalties associated with it just yet, who knows, they might come. The reputational damage that could come with setting targets and not achieving them would be so detrimental to our business, and a sort of reputation that we'd really struggle to claw back. So I think the next challenge is now how we move forwards and how we can be certain that we're going to achieve those targets. I'd say it's probably the biggest pressure to me, and hopefully we'll still be in our jobs by 2030.
I mean, I'd agree with this. Data is a problem. Managing it is a problem. It's a headache. But you're absolutely right, Gina. Getting there and achieving your targets is an even bigger, more fundamental problem. I think for us, scope one and two is going really, really well. We see a direct cost from wasting energy, you know, or wasting fish in our processes, etc. So there's a very good measure from top to bottom. So we've reduced our scope one and two emissions by over 15% over 2-3 years. We have all sorts of drivers for that. So 75% of the long-term finance, i.e. our borrowing as a company, is linked to hitting our sustainability targets. So that catches the attention of the chief exec and the board, that then opens up the capital you need to change your factories. And it's driven all the way down in terms of accountability, transparency, etc. So scope one and two, I would bet we get there. Scope three is nearly 90% of our emissions, typical in food. It's way outside of our control. It's all purchased goods and services, pretty much. So wild-caught fish, aquaculture and packaging are the top three in that. If you look at the carbon footprint of a can of tuna, 50 to 60% is the fishing operation. We don't own any fishing vessels. So you immediately see where the problems come up. You know, we're a member of an EU-funded project to look at making fishing more efficient. So you're trying things like coatings on vessels, switching to biofuels, electricity from renewables, etc., for the motors. It's at relatively early stages. So how do you do that through a massive global seafood business that works all the way around the world?
This one is a reflection, more like. So I do work with government and bodies like DEFRA and the Food Standards Agency. And part of what they're planning in the agenda is that they would move scope three responsibilities to the food businesses. And in terms of setting these targets, like you all mentioned, it's a huge portion of your supply chain that's completely out of your control. What most businesses do is outsource that part of it. Now, seeing as you'll very likely take ownership of your scope three full head on in the future, what do you reckon is the way forward? Outsourcing or actually getting your hands dirty and trying to unpick it, you know, bit by bit, you know, sector by sector, subsector by subsector?
I'd say it depends on the resource you have available. I think ideally, yeah, you'd want to get your hands dirty and get into that data. Is that realistic? I'm not sure that it is. And I think this is where we can really harness technologies and bring in the use of things like AI. And I'm not going to sit here and pretend like I know lots about AI, but I've heard it's wonderful. and I think that's where we really need to be smart in that space, because otherwise we are going to get too caught up in the data and we're not going to end up delivering anything towards our goals.
I think on scope three, everything is going to be small, bitty, incremental projects that are all hard fought and painful. And that's why it's difficult. And I think we're going to run into a point in another 5 years or so where some people are really struggling on their scope three targets or their progress against them. I'll give you an example. In the UK, we've changed the format for John West tuna. So it used to be in a PET shrink tower for the four pack. It was a 145-gram can. We've moved it to 125-gram can with the same amount of fish. So we save the carrier, which is sunflower oil, etc. We've reduced the weight of the can by about 15%. We get much better container loading. We save 60 to 80 containers coming from Seychelles or Ghana, where our plants are. This project is is great in terms of packaging reduction, reduction in raw materials, reduction in shipping, recyclability. It reduced the carbon footprint by 4 to 9%. The 9% came from using sunflower as your carrier. The 4% is from using a water-based carrier. So it just shows you where an agricultural commodity has a high embodied carbon within its high embodied footprint. That project took a couple of years from inception through to delivery. And it's actually quite a radical change in terms of you're going onto shelf with what looks like a smaller can. So will consumers accept it? You've got to put a load of marketing effort. You've got to do all of the work to restructure your factories to process a different shape of can. We've got a different distribution center in the UK in order to actually sort the cans and put the strip down them, which makes them recyclable. Took investment. And that saves 4,000 tonnes of carbon dioxide equivalent per year. Now, Thai Union's global footprint is about 4 million tonnes. Okay, so one really good project that took 2 years is taking a percent or so off, right? Yeah, well, not even that, 0.1, right? So it's. I think everything will work like that. Now, we can roll a project like that out and we can apply it to a French business, an Italian business, etc. But it gives you the scale of the problem. If you manage to take 15% of the weight out of your packaging, you're saving 20 grams of ingredients per product and you're still getting less than a 10% saving, it shows you how hard this is going to be.
Now I know why that can shrunk. My son lives on fish. Tuna, so yeah, he'll be much more impressed when I tell him that tonight instead of anything else I've done. I'm gonna wear a different coloured hat on this one, a bit of a white hat, I suppose. Not to say you were both wearing black hats there. Sorry. We've started some supplier engagement works over around about the last 9 months. We've done a real drive about speaking to our suppliers to try and get our hands dirty to some degree, not to outsource, just to try and understand where they are on their journey. I've been fairly surprised at how far quite a lot of the big businesses, how the blue chip guys. So when we go to speak to Waller or Muller, I'm not learning anything. Sort of, I'm not pushing them or anything. I'm learning stuff from them and slightly embarrassed sometimes when they tell us things they're doing. But I'm quite surprised at how far some of the SMEs are on this as well. For quite a lot of, for a sizable part of our scope three, in our big three, our big emission ingredients, protein, dairy, they're the big ones. There are verified reduction opportunities out there, so, and significant ones. I'm not talking 1 or 2%, I'm talking 30%, 40%, 50% reductions. The difference we've noticed is that comes at a premium, and that's every one of them has got a premium. I spoke to one meat supplier and he said, look, he says that can hugely reduce, like sort of close to sort of 3/4. Pull the carbon footprint of the product down. He says, but I don't think Greggs could afford it. So there's technologies out there, but it is just, yeah, they need to be commercialized a little bit. But it, to go back to your earlier point, I think the getting your hands dirty is the only way. I go to Chris's point as well. There's a million and one different projects going to have to happen. Some of them will be in that 4 to 9%. Some of them will hopefully be the 49% ones, but I think it is very much about getting your hands dirty, because then you understand your data and you understand where the challenges are.
Got one last question. So the consumers are at the center of the initiative for most of us. And it's often the case of, do we keep doing what we're doing or do we switch to something else? Much of the food industry depends on animal proteins. We can't escape it. In fact, the consumer profile suggests that over 70% of the UK population are meat eaters. So even when we're talking about flexitarians or alternative diets, we're talking of a mere 4%. So apart from initiatives where you are thinking of switching to something else, what else are you doing? Or how else do you think about meeting science-based targets that keep your main profit line, front and center of setting these targets, i.e. animal proteins, calling it for what it is, and at the same time, meeting targets that are reasonable? Or is it only a case of coming up with alternatives, switching and creating alternative meats or alternative products, or blending and mixing?
I'm happy to go first. I think it's a real mixture of all of them. So I don't think anybody who's got a high meat protein in their product range now, I don't think we can switch it off. So all of our research and our insight is, if somebody comes to Greg's for a sausage roll and we say we're not selling them anymore because we're doing something else, they won't just go and buy that something else. They've decided they want that sausage roll, they want that Bing sandwich, they want that burger, if they want a Max. So they'll just go somewhere else. It's a real education piece. So there has to be something. I personally think that there has to be some government policy involved in this to try and drive, and that comes back to that carbon taxation piece, to try and move that consumer behaviour on. As much as consumers are very interested, and we obviously deal, same as Chris, we deal with frontline consumers, although they're very, very interested and they see the wider sustainability topic as being important in terms of their purchase choice, it's not driving major change at the minute. So it needs to be, I personally think it needs policy intervention.
What do you think, Chris?
I mean, just to give you the nuance, our customer is typically a retailer, so it's not the end consumer. We are really responding to our customers' requirements, so the Tesco's, Carrefour's, Lidl's of this world. I think in many cases they're influenced by NGOs or regulation, things like that, and it's not a consumer-driven phenomenon as much. And you've seen things like the values action gap is something that's well documented, where people say, I want higher welfare chicken or I want sustainable fish, and when asked to pay slightly more, it collapses. So we've seen that. In terms of how do you respond to this as a business, we've got an interesting angle in the sense that if fish stocks are well managed, you've got a sustainable, nutritious product that's relatively low carbon. So it's got a nice point in that Venn diagram if everything goes right. And that's not to say that everything in fish does go right all of the time. Within fish, you've got a wide spectrum. So you've got things like small pelagics, so sardines, mackerel, anchovies, things like that are really, really, really low carbon, you know, similar to basically vegetable proteins. You've got tuna that's somewhere similar to fish. Tuna that is similar to chicken. And then you've got something like what we call prawns, but the rest of the world calls shrimp, that's farmed and is much lower than something like beef or lamb, but is higher than other things like fish. So you've got an interesting one. So we've got a project on reducing the carbon intensity of farmed shrimp. We've got an alternative protein business that's looking at, well, not just looking at, it's within the John West range. You can buy a John West plant-based salad already. And we're looking at how we would augment fish products potentially with things like, you know, seaweed proteins and so on. We've got a business that is very much about byproducts from fish processing to make sure you get more out of it in terms of nutraceuticals, pharmaceuticals, oils, whatever. So those are the way we have approached it. But I'm interested to challenge about the counter could be, why not choice edit out the bad things? And I don't think people really want to do that.
Yeah, I think the only thing I would add to that, like I say, we've focused a lot on carbon today. Sustainability goes a lot further than carbon. And whilst those are our science-based targets, we have other targets in our business as well, around increasing spend with SMEs, around the provenance of our produce as well, and working to higher animal welfare standards doesn't always go hand in hand with carbon either. So, for example, we made a business stance to change all our eggs to free-range eggs. That results in higher carbon. So whilst we're helping animal welfare, we then have to tackle that when it comes back to carbon as well. But I think we have to take a much broader approach and look at, okay, yes, we're not just going to remove meat from our menus, but let's look at the provenance of that meat. Can we use locally sourced British, Red Tractor, RSPCA, assured, those sorts of things? I think for us it's about remembering the bigger picture and not just getting caught up on carbon as well.
Any questions from the audience?
I was at the FDF Ambition Transform, which they were sort of like really bigging up. There was this transformational change, and I flagged to them that it was totally not transformational at all. What do you think would be the biggest transformational change for yourself, your industries and stuff like that? If blue sky thinking.
We've all got this what we've just talked about, that protein challenge is the big one. That's the red flag. It's the bit that flashes whenever you look at footprints. So anything to change that. So whether that's changing technology to make that there's a low carbon impact as it can be. I quite often talk at work, it's a bit of a throwaway saying about having a net zero pig. That's what vision. Well, vision should be a net zero pig. We're never going to get there. But if you can get very close to it, that might be that's one opportunity. The other opportunity is what Gina talked about earlier around product reformulation and going on that journey to reduce the protein. Can't really do that with your products, can you? I don't think I want a plant-based fish. It sounds wrong.
It's already there in the market, but I mean, you can augment with other proteins. So seaweed and algae proteins gets you quite an interesting product. Is one way of doing it where you could do the meet me in the middle type approach on a fish product, which is certainly interesting. I mean, the emissions for us are so inherently bound up in fishing sector. So it's improvements there that would drive performance for us, and then probably packaging as well. So, you talk about data and where you buy from. I think trying to find people with lower carbon steel or aluminium cans that is demonstrable and at the right price would make a change for us. But again, it comes back to the packaging on a can of tuna will be circa 15% of the total footprint. So even if you've got a 50% reduction in that, you're only taking, let's say, 7.5% off the footprint of the product. So it would be lovely if someone came to us and said, do you know what? We've got an electric process for this that's all powered by renewables and the emissions are down by this. That would be great. But does it fundamentally change what a can of tuna in the UK supermarket looks like in terms of embodied carbon? It makes it better, but it doesn't reduce it by 60%, 80%, etc.
I think for me, I'd love to be able to see a shift in consumer behaviour. Because there's a certain, only ever a certain amount that we are ever going to be able to do. And whilst consumers are saying that they want to eat more sustainably, they want to eat more healthy, it's not translating into the sales. And so something to alter consumer sort of choices would be fantastic for us. If you could find a way, please. Yeah, thank you.
Hi, just a question on climate disclosures and like going through the SBTI process, whether that helps you, whether you do or not disclose the climate risks and assessing the climate risks of the business.
So we didn't, not from an SBTI point of view, but from a TCFD perspective, it's included in our TCFD reports. We probably get more questions from stakeholders, from investors, really, investors and insurers. We get more questions around risks and opportunities nowadays than we do around the wider disclosures around emissions or whatever, because they're easy to see and understand. It's very much the risk and opportunities, probably more driven, if I think about the frameworks that we have to complete. So carbon disclosure projects really drives that thinking as well.
I've got one question. So in your experience, have you noticed, do science-based targets translate to, does it have a direct business benefit in terms of profits, for example? Or is it just a response to a requirement? You know, is there an incentive, for example, that you can argue to say, well, if you did this, you will benefit in that way in your business based on your experience so far?
I mean, we can't put an exact monetary value on it in terms of the business growth that's, of course, been attributed to it. However, we can certainly see the number of bids that we wouldn't have been able, or tenders that we wouldn't have been able to go for if we didn't have them in place. As to the weighting it may have held in those tenders, again, it's hard to say. Someone might say that 10% of a tender is sustainability, 10% is finance. But when it comes to it, let's be honest, I think finance is probably going to be the heavier weighting still. So I think it would be very hard to say if it's attributed to business growth. However, it's certainly helping us or playing a part in the business that we can go for.
It's customer driven for us. So there comes a point where we can't do business with many, many European retailers on the basis of not having SBTI. So that drove it in part. I think on scope one and two reduction, if you look at what we're trying to do in our factories, that is as much driven by cost saving and becoming more efficient. So trying to get your conversion cost per ton of finished product down. I went to our European factory directors meeting in April of this year, and it was very interesting to see utility costs being discussed at such a high level, in the sense that they were up there with everything else that contributes significantly to the conversion cost per ton for a factory. And we've got quite a number across Europe and Africa that are with entire Union Europe. And to me, I've seen a massive change in the course of the last decade. So I worked for a UK food manufacturer 10 years ago, where trying to get a conversion to LED lights seemed to be impossible and people left the fridge doors open and everything else, to what I see now. Part of that is a response to things like rising electricity and gas prices post the war in Ukraine starting. Part of it is driven by SBTI and other things. But I think we do see a much higher level of take up of what were good practices people were trying to push 10 years ago are now basically in food manufacturing sites, more or less as standard.
Can I just do a, sorry, just a quick follow on from that last point about scope one and two, and I was going to chew your ear off about this, Paul, as well. That's, I've always sort of seen a very clear delineation between like carbon reduction and price reduction, but now in the business I'm working in now, there's an anomaly around gas. Like, so we use a lot of ovens, and if we do a conversion from an electric oven to a gas oven, it's going to cost us a lot. It's going to cost us a lot less with gas, but it's going to cost us a lot more with CO2. So it's interesting to see what you're...
I'm happy to chat to you. So the change in the SB in the greenhouse gas protocol a couple of years, where it removed, so boring this, but it's really, so around about 3 years ago, the GHCP changed their rules around around our GHGO-backed renewable gas. So it was in the scope two rules. It was in their scope two rule document. I think they reviewed it and said, why is it in scope two? It should be in scope one. Have you got a scope one document? No. Right, we'll put it in when we create a scope one document. So it's created havoc. So we've invested 60%. We've moved 60% of our gas into renewable sources at a premium. And it's the right thing to do. We speak to Comdrust. It's the right thing to do. If you follow UK environmental reporting guidelines, you can claim the carbon benefits from an SBTI point of view because it's GHGP aligned. You can't, but yeah, it's been a bugbear and a discussion with our exec team. I'm sort of hold over the calls about it. Don't write that down. On a fairly regular basis. I feel like I've just sort of unloaded there. Yeah, three Hail Marys and I'm done. The challenge you have got is the reversal of, so we're pretty heavy gas users in about four sites, but it's a side, because we've removed the electricity impact in our scope one and two, it's now a big part. So gas and diesel are the two big parts. Trying to electrify those processes that use gas, so gas ovens, is a huge capital investment, like millions and millions of pounds capital investment, and it's four times the operating cost just based on the electricity cost alone. So it really doesn't make any financial sense to do that.
I just want to get back to what you were saying there about you've gained a lot of tenders because you had SBTI. How do all three of you manage your suppliers at that end? Do you put a weighting on sustainability for your suppliers? And have you actually made decisions on, I'm not using that one, even though they're really, really cheap?
I'm happy to start.
Yeah, did you see the boss look
silence.
At you?
Yeah. During our supplier onboarding, it's a very lengthy process to onboard a supplier into a big organisation. However, a couple of years back, we introduced an ESG section into our supplier onboarding for answers that they have to provide. So it goes into their policy, it goes into their science-based targets, do they have a net zero plan, etc. There's only a few in there that they must answer yes to, otherwise we won't consider them. And they're mainly around modern slavery policies, that sort of thing at the minute. So I wouldn't say that we're making decisions actively on their sustainability. sort of credentials. If they answer no, we may still bring them on board, but it's then looking at how we support them and on that process to achieve what we're asking them to do. And then it's all onboarded in our system that our suppliers go into, and we track that as well. So we can look each quarter or each year on the developments that our suppliers are making and how many of like percentage of them have commitments towards that. So, yeah.
I mean, we've recently moved across to using EcoVadis as our benchmark. I wouldn't say we've made decisions not to. Well, if we take the modern slavery risk one, if we're using if a supplier is trying to onboard and they're from a certain place and it's a certain activity or certain commodity and it flashes as red risk, we'd probably say no. Well, I know for a fact we would say no. With some of the other areas, and we're collecting this data through EcoVadis, so that we collect it in sort of more sort of binary ways in the past, I wouldn't say it made us say no, but it would be a consideration. So we would look at something. We would rather work, especially with some of the suppliers, SMEs, if they've got 3/4 of the things that you need. So from a commercial point of view, it's great. From a service point of view, it's great. They're well located, blah, blah, blah. But they've just got some gaps in their ESG. We would rather say to them, right, we'll work with you to close some of those gaps over the next 2 years. And when we come to retender, if you hasn't closed the gaps, you'll probably not be in the running.
I think for us, the yes, no criteria are around biodiversity, not climate change. So the boats that we would buy tuna from for our factories have either got to be in a fishery improvement project in MSC assessment or MSC certified. We've seen a pipeline of getting everybody into fishery improvement projects, FIPS, to assessment, to actually getting MSC certified product. And interestingly, nearly half of the world's tuna is now MSC certified in terms of fisheries. So it's a fundamental change over a decade. Similar approach on human rights in terms of putting a huge amount of due diligence work into actually auditing ourselves, the vessel owners and the vessels in our supply chain. Because I think particularly those two are where we were first particularly attacked by NGO campaigns that go back 10 to 15 years, but they're also some of the most fundamental impacts or most material issues that we have. So that's it really for us. I think there's always an interesting one about, to me, I find yes, no thresholds more interesting than here's our survey and questionnaire, can you fill it in? Because as a, you know, you'll be in a similar place from your company, you'll get it from retailers left, right and centre. Can you fill in this spreadsheet of questions? Great. What happened next?
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. Just filling in our RSPCM and soy and belly stuff.
So what you're after are, rather than a spreadsheet with 80, 90 questions in it, is you're after 4 or 5 yes-no criteria that actually push something. And I've sat down with many retailers and said, please, no more spreadsheets. Please, firm, I want this or I don't want that. And if you don't do this, we're not doing business. And they say, yeah. And the next week, you get another spreadsheet.
Hello. All right. First of all, Paul, love the socks.
Thank you.
Yeah, this is a question for you, Paul, because we work with...
You've just teed me up with the socks comment, haven't you?
Absolutely. Yeah, of course. You know.
You've been on a course.
Yeah. So we work with Northern Spain, Asturias, that region there, and there's quite a lot of co-ops, especially for dairy and beef. So they have 1,200 farms and things like that. And they do a lot of carbon emission reduction work and also with with biodiversity as well. And one of the best things that was working for the co-ops is to actually incentivize the farmers by offering like an incentive of a certain amount of per liter of milk or per kilo of beef or something like that. Is that something that could be kind of transferred into supermarkets? Because obviously I think a lot of the food emissions come from dairy and beef. So could that translate?
It could, definitely. So we do that already with fair trade. So it's the same fair trade model that we've got, where we pay a premium to use the fair trade badge on my products, and that gives it credibility and everyone wants to buy it and gets a nice feeling from it. And that money trickles down to the producer group. So it's the same principle. I have to be honest, until you've mentioned it, I've never really thought about having something like that for any of the protein, any dairy or protein stuff.
Thank you. So one final question and just a quick thought, a quick answer. The science-based targets are obviously involving different departments, different groups within your organization, procurement, ingredients and food, preliminary and so on. How do you manage the resistance from one department to the other? Because I imagine they wouldn't be facing the same kind of challenge, whether it's from a data point of view or requirements and so on. How do you manage the resistance across, you know, divisions within your organization?
Anybody? I'm happy to go. Yeah. I'm happy to go first. So we do it. So our governance, our sustainability governance structure is set. So we've got a standard structure, which is a sustainability committee with a couple of experts and then our exec team. And then topic areas have their own governance groups underneath. Each one of those governance groups is led by, is championed by a member of the exec. So, and then within there, they pull in the key experts and they work collaboratively. And those banging of heads, which generally something healthy comes out of it, the exec member leads and manages that to make sure they can make sure they can resolve, so that collaboration happens. Okay. It's very simple.
I think transparency and disclosure, both publicly and within your company, are really, really useful tools. So, you know, that it is transparent where you're going right and where you're going wrong is absolutely fundamental. You've got to have, you know, it's got to be spread out. It can't be the sustainability team on scope three. It's got to be particularly procurement functions. So for us, if most of our scope three is purchased goods and services, it's not going to work without them being targeted and incentivized to deliver it. It's absolutely fundamental. I do feel that the world is quite different to a decade ago, in that I didn't feel buy-in from purchasing departments on this sort of subject a decade ago, and you do see it a lot more now. You know, we were talking about commercial directors, and I was saying in a meeting I had with a previous company, we were a supplier to Greggs 5 years ago, the commercial director of Greggs only wanted to talk about sustainability when he came to visit us as a supplier, which was one of those weird moments where he said, this is very different. So that's how I see it. I think, but I'll come back to transparency and disclosure. I think the phrase, you know, sunlight's the best form of disinfectant is one that's relevant here. You've got to out the bad performance, either internally or publicly, better publicly, and report honestly, because that becomes a driving mechanism where a chief exec goes mad and says, why has this happened?
I think the only thing I can add, we have a very similar structure to you in terms of and how we've embedded it into different stakeholders and making them responsible. But one thing that we have found is that people like to hear from like-minded people. And the best example for us of that in our business is chefs. Chefs don't want to hear from me, who's never really stepped foot in a kitchen, to go and tell them what to do. But we made the smart decision to invest in a new role in the business, which was a culinary director for sustainability. He was already really well respected in the business at a very high level. Since he's moved into that role, I have never seen chefs so invested in sustainability. We had 16 chefs at a course on a Friday afternoon in Farnborough, which was a miracle, across our exec development chef team. And so for us, we're now looking at how we can translate that into other areas of the business as well, so that we've got people hearing from like-minded people, and that's where we're really seeing change in this.
Thank you. Big thanks to our panel.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Food Matters Live podcast. We've got some exciting news to share about more live events this year. We're heading to Manchester in May, Ascot in October, and Dublin in November. And for the first time, we're hosting an event in mainland Europe. In September 2025, we'll be in Rotterdam. Join us as we inspire the future of food. Learn more and sign up at foodmatterslive.com. And we look forward to seeing you there.